You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 17th of August, 2025, actually very early in the on the 17th of August. If you guys haven't been following the Solzhenitsyn series of readings and my responses, please go do so. People are talking about it all over the place. I uploaded a new paper on Thailand on Patreon. And of course, I have at least two new books coming out. I can never remember. And these are tremendously time-consuming. If you've written to me and I've not gotten back to you, I apologize. It's not done. It's not a personal matter or that I'm arrogant or anything like that. Anyway, last week I left you in the middle of a discussion on the ideology of money, especially the ideology of money concerning the Antichrist, the Mosaic, the end of the Antichrist, the end of days. And of course, you can't talk about that whatsoever without talking about the Jews. But the Jews were, to use an overused metaphor, the yeast of capitalism, oligarchy, plutocracy, the world financial power. And they were able to do this because earthly values were made absolute only with them. They don't believe in immortality of the soul. There's no religious element to them. All of their values are to be found on earth. And this is why they rejected Christ and his followers. And they rushed to possess wealth by usury at a rate beyond others, other groups of people, in the classical world especially. This was the reason for the dominance of the Jews, or at least the ideological reason, for the dominance of the Jews in world trade and world finance from pre-Christian times on. They settled along globally important trade routes in great numbers. For example, in Palestine at this point, let's say around the time of the birth of Christ, the words Jew and usurer became synonyms. And this continued among many peoples of antiquity in the Middle Ages, had that very similar connection between Jews and usury, and certainly after Christ's resurrection. I keep making reference to somebody who doesn't get talked about much. He does in certain academic areas, but even there, not so much. Jacques Attali. One of the most powerful men in Europe, one of the creators of the mentality of the European Union, was a Jewish banker, one of the most powerful men in the regime. But his specific purpose within the regime is as an intellectual. He has a doctorate in economics from Paris, and then strangely from there, you know, gets these tremendous jobs in the presidential office, and then at the European Bank, Reconstruction, everything else. The European Union as an ideological entity can be traced to him. He wrote a book called Jews, Peace, and Money in 2002, and he explains the phenomenon this way. I may have quoted this before, but it's worth quoting again. God asked Abraham to be rich so he can serve him. Isaac and Jacob confirmed the necessity of enriching oneself in order to please God. God blesses Isaac's wealth and allows him to buy the birthright of his brother Esau. It's proof that everything has a material value, even in the form of lentil soup. Money is a machine that transforms the sacred into the secular, liberates from coercion, channels violence, organizes solidarity, helps resist the demands of non-Jews. It's a wonderful means of serving God. The Jewish people made money a unique and universal element, instrument of exchange, just as they made their God a unique and universal element of superiority. In this cruel world ruled by force, money gradually turns out to be the highest form of organization of human relations, allowing all conflicts, including religious ones, to be resolved without violence. The authors of the Talmud were themselves mostly traders and experts in economics. So you see why he's of immense power, but doesn't really get spoken of too much. He says too much about the Jews. He fully admits the Jews at the center of revolutionary movements, capitalism, Marxism, and post-Marxism. Not only that, he defends it. And I love the line, helps to resist the demands of non-Jews. Now, he's an atheist, so when he keeps referring to God, I'm not sure what he's referring to here. So you have to read him there's esoteric meanings being laid out here. This man laid the intellectual foundation for the European Union. He's an atheist, and importantly, he's a transhumanist. His biography doesn't make any sense, like it was altered. But, you know, he talks about the wealth of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and he makes a very childish error. Wealth in the ancient world had no connection with what wealth means in 2025. In fact, there's no connection at all. In the classical world, wealth came with tremendous obligations. It wasn't connected to personal indulgence. And even Vladimir Solovyov, who was a philo-Semite, he even had to admit that, quote, the Jews are attached to money not at all for the sake of the material benefit, but because they now find in it the main instrument for the triumph and glory of Israel. That is, in their view, the triumph of God's work on earth. Now, if that's a philo-Semite, what are the anti-Semites like? This is typical. You know, I've shown how the founders of the modern left, the 19th century, from Proudhon to Marx to Bakunin, a few other examples, all laid out what the Jews were like, the revolutionary nature of the Jew. There's nothing shocking about any of this. But this, the way that Attali writes here, believing that money somehow is not coercion, resisting the demands of non-Jews, while cohesion and money are the ways that this can be done, and then using that to dare to interpret the Old Testament. You even have this in Jewish Proverbs, like in the Gemara. There's a line that says, all parts of our body depend on the heart, but our heart depends on the wallet. I saw that a long time ago. They even identified themselves with money. The famous poet Heine, in his Confessions, says, what is called today the hatred of the rich was once called the hatred of the Jews. There's an old Jewish proverb, and especially in Russia, that says, the truth illuminates, but it's money that warms. In other words, money is far more powerful and useful than truth. You have to be very careful in reading any of these people, especially when they start talking about things like God or the Jewish spirit or spirit in general. Be very careful about how they're writing. Nothing can be taken at face value. What God is Judaism serving with their extraordinary wealth? We already discussed where Marx argued that the money itself had become the Jewish God. And the Jewish mentality had subjugated even the Christian world in his 1844 article on the Jewish question, Marx considered it necessary to destroy religion in general. I'll repeat myself here. Well, I don't know if this is a repeat or not. I may have said this in my lecture on Karl Marx's The Jewish Question. But he says, money is the jealous god of Israel, before whom no other god can resist. Money degrades all other gods of man and turns them into commodities. Money is the universal, self-asserting value of all things. Therefore, it has deprived the whole world, both the human world and of nature, their own value. Money is the essence of his labor. And being alienated from man, and this alien essence subjugates man, man worships it. The God of the Jews has become worldly, has become a world God. The bill is the real God of the Jews. Every once in a while, among nationalists of various types, you'll hear someone talk about Moses Hess. He's not the easiest guy to read. Be very careful. Hegel was never a teacher of Karl Marx. Marx was 13 when Hegel died. Marx was the opposite of Hegel. However, Feuerbach and Moses Hess, they were a different story. Moses Hess was an ally, almost a brother of Marx. They worked together in many undertakings. Capitalism, of course, this is where kind of Karl Marx got the idea that capitalism is the intermediate stage in the universal mission of Judaism. So Hess says, money is social blood, but alienated spilled blood. The Jews, whose universal historical mission lies in the sphere of the natural history of the social animal world and consists in turning humanity into a predatory animal, have finally completed the work for which they were destined. The mystery of Judaism and Christianity was revealed in the Judeo-Christian commercial world. And you shudder when you read something like that. In the future, then, Hess says Judaism will direct humanity to the final goal, he says, the era of universal human unity, a universal and singular order. Well, in the same way, in Marxism, capitalism and free trade, the animal self-interest, were essential to the socialist revolution, which was to come later. And we discussed a while ago why that was the case. The Communist Manifesto, of course, is merely a very skeletal outline, at best, of Marxism. It was meant for general acceptance, general literate acceptance. It was not for philosophers or for anyone else. But it was not merely Marx and Engels. It was the collective work of a number of esoteric groups, I should say, like paramasonic groups, Fraternal Democrats, the Society of Human Rights, the Union of the Rejected, the Union of the Just. One of the bases comes from the Red Catechism of the German People, which was sort of it wasn't really a book of Hess, but a bunch of his writings were thrown together and given that title. It doesn't matter. It all means the same thing. The final liberation of the Jews will come when Christ is no longer worshipped, to put it bluntly. Marx and Hess were very close. They worked together often. In fact, it was Hess who introduced Engels to the very concept of communism as an idea. Like the early Marx, Hess would use esoteric language to communicate his agenda. But academics today, reading his work, take him at face value. They end up in absurdity. But most of the time, it's Jews who talk about Moses Hess because Gentiles don't want to touch him. Again, in Hess's 1862 Rome and Jerusalem, in his third letter, he says the following. Very few indeed possess the noble spirit which animated the Jewish saints. Most people are anxious to secure as much immortality as possible for themselves, and for themselves alone. True it is that the end of days, when the knowledge of God will fill the earth, is still far off, that we firmly believe that the time will come when the Holy Spirit of our nation will become the property of humanity, and the earth will become a grand temple wherein the Spirit of God will dwell. It is true the reign of the Spirit exists already, but only as a germ of the spiritual light. To develop this germ to its fullest possibilities, so that it will create social values, their labor, along with the Jewish people, the most intellectual, moral, and creative of modern nations, namely Germany, France, and England. That is almost a catechism of symbolism and esoteria. Of course, again, Hess was an atheist. Now remember, Hess considered that book his magnum opus. So what he writes there is definitive for him. Clearly, you can't take a lot of what he says at face value, because he was an atheist. It's clear, though, that he's talking about Jews as a global ruling class. The Kabbalah infuses all of his work. That pseudo-mysticism and Marxism, that connection is very clear. The language used really can only be understood in that very same spirit of mystification. He's talking about the transformation of the entire planet into what the Kabbalists call the Temple of Solomon. In that form, he talks about in very, very Kabbalistic, typical Kabbalistic ways, the shards of light that the Jews, along with the advanced and progressive left, will bring together in the form of social values. While using such language, he claims that the spirit of the Jewish nation will dominate the globe through revolution, and this is certainly how Marx understood it. In the same book from the 12th letter, he says this: "The civilized nations are at present making preparations for a common exploitation of nature. This will be carried on by means of labor based on scientific principles, and all social parasites being excluded. They're preparing themselves for the new era through struggles for free national soil, by attempts at abolishing race and class rule, by endeavoring to organize an association, that's with a capital A, and by the cooperation of all production, all forces of production. In this association, the antagonism between capitalist speculation and productive labor, as well as the contrast between philosophic speculation and scientific work, will simultaneously disappear. I know well the need of wholesome and just labor conditions, which should be based solely on the exploitation of nature by man, is also strongly felt in Jewry." Again, your typical academic reading this has no idea what's going on. I don't think anyone could really penetrate every single word. Every single word has a double meaning attached to it. But for our purposes, the association, again, a capital A, meaning it's a technical term, that's a planned economy. All the forces of production in one place. The conquest of nature, meaning nature then is, instead of dominating man, man dominates it, but of course, man is a part of nature. Atali's transhumanism is connected to this. But non-Jewish writers have no means of interpreting passages like these. Again, the secondary literature on this is almost entirely Jewish. He doesn't talk about ending speculation only by connecting it to productive labor, as if they're in any position to talk about that. The Jews of Europe, and he well knew, dominated capitalistic speculation. In fact, they created the notion. So when he's talking about social parasites, who's he talking about? Of all things. Speculation was and is a Jewish domain. Just like today, race and class rule, which he mentions, refers to, of course, Christian rulers, especially monarchs and the clergy. But keep in mind, there's always a difference between the Jews working productively in exile in other words, for Gentile states, and then working after the advent of the Messiah. So that makes productive labor a complex idea. Once they were in Israel, you know, he was a very early Zionist. That should be done on a completely communal socialist form. At least, at the very minimum, he's talking about the new science, the Industrial Revolution, is on the verge of creating the new man, one ruled over by the Jewish spirit or the association, even prior to the advent of the Messiah. Or, as is more likely, the Messiah will be the collective Jewish Holy Spirit. Either way, it's a purely secular idea. In Roman Jerusalem, this is his central work, not just of Moses Hess's life, but of socialism in general. Hess defined the Jewish nation as the elect. He's an atheist, so it has to be, they're self-chosen. There is no God. It's just their mission. That's a condition that can never change. That Palestine is the homeland of the Jews, and Jewish ritual, the so-called religion, is the best guarantee of Jewish nationality. He sought the establishment of the Jewish state, 85 years before it was founded. He saw Jewish socialism as the only answer to anti-Semitism. He uses these mawkish phrases like this: "I wish to pour out my feelings of Jewish patriotism in a cry of pain, which, however, was soon again muffled in my breast by the greater pain awakened by the position of the European proletariat." Well, he's not talking about the average Gentile worker. According to Hess, this national Jewish republic is to be established in what they pretend is the historical homeland of the Jewish people, socialist, public ownership of land and the means of production. Of course, they're quite silent on its connection to the great powers and all that. There was a time, though, where Hess, and this is his own self-interpretation, the nonsense Dreyfus affair. We don't have time to get into that. It's a mythic. Nothing about that makes any sense. And the equally mythic pogroms. That's what changed his mind about cooperating with Gentile socialists. That's probably not true, but he says that after the fact. The Dreyfus affair was invented entirely. That's unfortunately beyond the scope. Although I'll tell you, it featured some of the worst, albeit early, forms of Photoshop I've ever seen. It was the case, however, that these, you know, make-believe or exaggerated pogroms and the so-called blood libel trials created an artificial source for Jewish cohesiveness that didn't exist before. And that he knows quite well. He instructed, when he died, he's at the Jewish cemetery in Cologne. The monument says, "The father of German social democracy." In other words, the father of Jewish socialism, of German socialism. And Jews were very upset by this, because they say this gives anti-Semites too much ammunition. It gives anti-Semites the ability to say that socialism and the left are Jewish creations in their radical forms. Which, of course, is true. Jewish writers don't like this. Regardless, and this actually is connected to Hess, even prior to Darwin, the anti-Christian revolutionary movement, the merchant capitalist, a movement based on usury, they divided peoples into backward peoples and progressive peoples, or enlightened peoples, something that could exist only in modernity. And that lay at the foundation of colonialism. When Darwin's Origin of the Species came out, Marx was extremely enthusiastic. That's what scientific communism was based on, according to him. It was given its pseudo-scientific, racial, and biological justification. In fact, Marx wrote, "Darwin's book is very important. It forms the basis of my idea of natural selection and the class struggle throughout history." But Darwin himself stated that his basic theory came from economics, especially from reading Malthus in one of his biographies. Autobiographies. But what people like Hess and Marx were going for, the concept of Judaism as an atheistic sect interprets the future as an era of universal monism, singularity, the long-awaited kingdom of the Messiah. But again, this is purely earthly, purely materialistic. Talmudic Judaism is the most materialistic religion on earth, and really, hence, not a religion at all. It's just an ethnic sect that has certain rituals. At best, you can say the service to the Ein Sof, the eternal flux, which is their god in the Kabbalah, so merged with the passion for profit that money actually became God quite literally. And the prototype, of course, is the worship of the horned golden calf by the Jews of the Old Testament, the same times Moses came down from the mountain. As far as the Jews were concerned, of course, they have no connection with those people racially, but they certainly have no connection with them theologically, because the golden calf actually won. And Karl Marx is very clear, as did Proudhon and Bakunin and so many others, leftists, extreme leftists at the time, that remains the God of the Jews. There's a very pompous professor at the University of California, a Jew, Yuri Selezkin. He wrote a book in 2004 called The Jewish Century. The Russian translation is actually The Age of Mercury, but they both mean the same thing. I say he's very pompous in the sense that he over-theorizes this. We've mentioned on the show, Mercury is the god of property, boundaries, commerce, communication, including, divination, eloquence, sophism, financial gain, languages, thievery, trickery, wandering. And I say that because he's also the guide of souls to the underworld. So in Schleskine's mentality, the Jewish worldview is based on Mercury. Hence, it's a Mercurian world. This is what he says. And it's an admission that, it's becoming more and more common. He says, the modern era is a Jewish era, and the 20th century is a Jewish century. Modernization consists in everyone becoming agile, literate, talkative, intellectually sophisticated, and professionally flexible city dweller. In people and symbols being cultivated, not in fields and herds, in wealth being sought for the sake of education, education for the sake of wealth, and both for their own sake. In princes and peasants being transformed into teachers and merchants, hereditary privileges being replaced by acquired prestige, and the place of social classes being taken by individuals, small families, and well-read tribes. Modernization is when everyone becomes a Jew. Some princes and peasants do it better, others worse, but no one is capable of becoming a better Jew than the Jews. In the age of capital, they are the most enterprising of entrepreneurs. Karl Marx himself began with the proposition that the final liberation of the world from Jewry was possible only through the complete destruction of capitalism, since capitalism is undisguised Jewry. And he goes on to say, one of the reasons why the 20th century became the Jewish century is that the Nazi attempt to exterminate the Jews led to the canonization of Nazism as absolute evil and the transformation of the Jews into universal victims. From being the chosen people of the Jewish God, the Jews became the chosen people of the Nazi executioners. By becoming the chosen people of the Nazi executioners, they became the chosen people of the post-war Western world. The Holocaust became the measure of all crimes. Anti-Semitism became the only unforgivable form of ethnic intolerance in Western public life. No other form of ethnic hostility, however chronic and bloody, is designated by a special exclusive term. Unless we count the word racism, which is analogous to anti-Semitism, but it lacks tribal specificity. the same time and for the same reason. Israel became a country to which the general rules did not apply. One reason for the widespread dissemination of the new image of Israel is the degree of power and influence of American Jews, whose Jewishness and perhaps Americanism depend on Israel maintaining its status as a chosen people and the Holocaust overcoming all the boundaries of history. The U.S. is remarkable in that Mercurianism, including meritocracy, is the official state ideology. This is why I say there are no conspiracies anymore. This is a major press. The Jewish Century came out in a major press. He's a regular academic. And he's talking like this. 20 years ago, you'd go to prison in the EU for saying things like this if you weren't a Jew yourself. He's saying that modernity is Judaism, and Judaism is modernity. Michael Hoffman, I remember many years ago when I first came across him, he argued that the Holocaust, so-called, has replaced the crucifixion as a defining moment of Western civilization, or at least World War II. It is the defining element of Judaism. To reject the Holocaust is to reject the entire sine qua non of today's Jews. And Schlieskind clearly agrees with him on this. He continues, American Jews have a right to succeed because they're Americans, just as Soviet Jews of the 20s and 30s had a right to succeed because they were Soviet. Of all the non-Jewish states known to world history, only in the pre-war USSR did the Jews play a more important role in political life than in the post-war US. Jews are the wealthiest religious community in the United States. They have the highest family incomes, 72% above the national average. Remember, this is written 20 years ago. The highest rate of self-employment, 3 times the national average. And the greatest representation among the richest Americans, 40% of the 1982 Forbes list of the richest Americans. That has gone up. Even new immigrants from the former USSR begin earning above the national average within just a few years of arrival. The main question regarding the future of the Jews in Russia is not whether the Jews will become peasants, as some czars and communists hoped. In the age of universal Mercurianism, the Jewish age, the main question is whether the Russians will learn to be Jews. Now, I think that deserves to be quoted at length, because it admits a tremendous amount. Something that only a Jew could say. Now, why could it be that when Jews emigrate, let's say, to the U.S., within a few years, they're making way above the national average income? Well, it's not because they're geniuses. They're nothing of the kind. It's due to their fanatical cohesion. They hire and they educate each other. You see, what used to be National Socialist theory has now been repackaged by Schlieskind and has been made mainstream because it can no longer be denied. Now, this Mercury versus Apollo dichotomy, this is so, I don't want to say pedantic, it's not the right word, but it's overly typological. The Mercurian idea develops a culture of purity, the national myths that cultivate their separation from the essentially the Goyim. Allows them to provide international services, such as like intermediaries, diplomacy, or services that are taboo for the local Apollonian culture, linked to death, magic, sexuality, banking. Apollonians are essentially the Goyim. Schlieskind develops this thesis by arguing that the Jews, the most successful of these Mercurian peoples, have increasingly influenced the course and nature of Western societies, particularly during the age, during the early and middle periods of Soviet Marxism, and that modernity can be seen as a transformation of Apollinarians into Mercurians. Now, he doesn't need all of this, you know, using these mythical characters. He doesn't need all that. It's overly pompous. But it seems that he's using this to answer Dugin's, or the Eurasian distinction between Atlanticists, the land power and the sea power. But Jews are talking like this all the time. Seletzkin also talks about the critical role of Jews in the creation of the American experience. A young nation that comes from modernity itself. He says Americanism depends on Israel maintaining its status as a chosen nation and overcoming the boundaries of the history with the Holocaust, where more Jews live in New York than in Israel. Jewish state symbols have been adopted, and where state policy is determined today by such Jewish structures like the American Jewish Congress, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and Federal Reserve System. So there's no more conspiracies. Everything that we've been arguing for the last, I've been arguing for the last 30 years now, is fully admitted by Jewish authors and being taught in these university classrooms. But of course, this is a very good thing, because this is progress. It's all in how it's contextualized. Now, of course, he wrote this book long before our situation in Israel. And this is where cracks can be found in the regime. I mean, Seletzkin will go so far as to say that the regime is essentially a manifestation of Jewry. I don't even say that. I may say that now, but he can get away with it. The philosophy of money, we can go back to 9th century Khazaria. One of my favorite topics. It was a huge territory. Astrakhan, the Caspian Sea, you know, Dnieper, Crimea, where the Jews fled after the defeat of Khazaria, moved in the 10th century, throughout Europe. And today, we have the phenomenon of New Khazaria, prior at least to the 2022 war. The headquarters of this was to be Dnipro, but I think Russian strikes have made that no longer the case. You can't ignore Chabad Lubavitch here. This is extremely important. They were initially based in New York. They were going to go to Ukraine. To Dnipro, the capital of New Khazaria. And this was going to be their version of the Jerusalem Temple. It's a purely secular notion. I mean, the real physical Jerusalem is meant to be the site of the third temple, right? Religious Jews think the Jerusalem king is going to descend there. So New Khazaria isn't all that popular with certain religious circles, tiny minorities, but just like Zionism is. But today, it may be the only option after Iran flattened much of Israel's critical infrastructure over the last couple of months. Now, I know I've argued this before, but it's absolutely worth repeating. Chabad Lubavitch is the most powerful expression of Jews, especially in Eastern Europe, certainly the wealthiest. They've developed their sense of sacred history. They've offered an alternative, revolving around Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the last Rebbe of Chabad Lubavitch, who died in New York in 1994, recognized as the Messiah by most of this sect and many, many, many other Orthodox Jews at the time. The Hasidic point of view is that he will be resurrected and take power over the world as the Jewish Messiah. He is the Antichrist, in other words, what we would call Antichrist. A temple for Schneerson has already been built in Dnipro by Igor Kolomoisky. Despite all his troubles, even prior to the war, was one of the heads of the Jewish oligarchs who ruled Ukraine. His throne is waiting for him at the Chabad Menorah Center, by far the largest Jewish complex in the entire world. I don't know about his physical condition now. I have the feeling it may not exist. But I don't know that for a fact. But oligarchs can rebuild it somewhere. Ukrainian oligarchs wanted to make Dnipro and Odessa, not Jerusalem, the focus of Jewish life, using Schneerson as its central figure. I mean, at least it would be more historically defensible and consistent. The Menorah Center, which was this humongous Jewish cultic center, in Dnipro, the city. I think the fourth largest city in Ukraine, about 1 million people. It was initially proposed by Rabbi Shmuel Kaminsky, and funded by the head of the Jewish community there, Gennady Boglyubov, and the president of the United Jewish Community of Ukraine, founder of the European Jewish Union, Kolomoisky himself. These are all oligarchs in their own right, and they finance this. The philosophy of this menorah center and its construction is it combines three elements of Judaism, so-called spirituality, ethnic culture, or I should just say ethnicity, and their business interests, all in one complex. Now, Schneerson himself was born in Nikolaev, Ukraine. He was raised in Dnipro. Back then it was known as Ekaterinoslav. His father was the chief rabbi there. He was arrested in 1939 by the Soviet authorities. In other words, the most powerful Jewish cult group, Shabbat Lubavitch, they're not worried about Jerusalem. They're not worried about Israel. The Mosaic, their Messiah, their Redeemer, has nothing to do with Israel. It's about the resurrection of Schneerson to take his throne in eastern Ukraine. Now, as far as the war is concerned, once the war is over, this can be rebuilt. I'm not sure about their options here. BlackRock has something to do with it. It's really going to depend on the nature of the peace between the West and Russia, but this isn't all that dissimilar to how Khazaria became Jewish. If you've read Gumilev's The Zigzag of History, it's actually, he makes this point very clear. In Khazaria, it was basically a Turkic multicultural empire, there was a coup where the second leader after the Kagan himself was a Jew, Obadiah, the son of the Dagestani military leader, Abulan, the first major figure to accept Judaism. And this is how Gumilev describes it, and I'm translating it here. The circumstances under which this state coup, not so much a religious one, took place are veiled by many legends, all of which, without exception, seem fictitious. They have one goal, to hide the true state of affairs from history. The same thing is occurring today in Ukraine. The victory of the Maidan movement in February of 2014 was used by those using legitimate anger against the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, and his corrupt clique. In other words, they took legitimate issues and directed them against Yanukovych in particular, although he certainly wasn't the author of their problems. It was a deflection. Oligarchy and plutocracy destroyed Ukraine, not the office of the president. The main leaders of this revolt were Shabbat Lubavitch. The oligarchs themselves are. Thus, they have enormous support in the U.S. and the EU. So, it might not be going too far to say that what happened in 2014 was a Shabbat revolution. Revolution with goals known only to a few initiates. Crimea was saved from this by Putin's quick action and the revolt of Novorossiya, or Donbas, against Kiev, avoiding an invasion of the Donbas by Western-trained Ukrainian armies. Unfortunately, Ukraine was driven to a state of poverty and depression that really had never known before. An impoverished country of highly educated, formerly very motivated people, Slavic people, ruled over by non-Slavic oligarchs. And from that arose the idea of New Khazaria to be erected in eastern Ukraine, the throne of the resurrected Schneerson. What's going to happen in the near future, as far as that's concerned, is speculation. Now, the regime, its financial core is finance. The American Federal Reserve System, I mean, it's a Judaic concept. Alan Greenspan, Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen. On a local scale, the central banks of the EU. The global financial system is not just a global power, but also has a global agenda. The maintenance of what the Great Reset or the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So, Antichrist rules the world with the most effective tools in a society dedicated to materialism. And that tool, really I should say singular, is money. And its power is total. This money, of course, is stolen. Rent-seeking, usury is theft. So it's alienated that way. And then, with that money, it's been turned into an instrument of power. The Antichrist also steals the way of expressing the value of money. Now, there's been a few Russian authors, Mikhail Nazarov, who's head of the Union of the Russian People. The concept of number. Now, the word number as a term is an extremely complex one. You read St. Augustine, number is the foundation of the universe. It's just another word for form. In Plato's sense, the entire structure in space, say the law of gravitation, deep into matter, the structure of matter itself, all of this has a harmonious numerical order. DNA itself, all of which taken together, make a mockery of Darwinism. Therefore, the true basis of the material world is ideal. You know, mathematics is a non-material science. It's idealistic. It doesn't invent anything itself, but it does reveal the properties of the universe, at least in Plato's sense. Now, what the devil has done, what the regime has done, it's taken that concept of number from God and inverted it, like it inverts everything. To invert is to put something upside down. To pervert is to turn away. Becomes then the ideological basis of matter into an instrument of global electronic digital control. It creates numbers in the sense of quantities. 1, 2, 3, 4. It creates digits on a computer screen. That's not what the word number initially meant. And so when you read Augustine and a few other Platonists early on, they use the word number, and it's very, you don't know what they're talking about. You have to understand that's exactly what they meant. But money, as the means, or really the passion for greed and lust, that's openly talked about by Attali, Jacques Attali. He paints the picture. He's not hiding anything. Of course he believes in a unified world, no state borders. He loves the idea of nomadism because he talks about, just as Marx did, that the nomads lose their traditional attachment to their country, community, and family. He doesn't mean literal nomads like in Central Asia. He's talking about that lifestyle. So in the same book I mentioned above, he says this. It sounds like something that we would write as something to, but no, but he's writing it as a positive. He thinks this is something we should be proud of. He says, basis of the technology of the future is a microcircuit built into all sorts of objects, which will become, as it were, an extension of our sense organs, the functions of our body. We will be able to connect microprocessors to various organs of the body in order to constantly monitor possible deviations from the norm. It will simultaneously serve as an identity card, a checkbook, telephone, and fax machine. It will effectively become a nomad's passport. Means of control will be omnipresent. Thus, order based on force gives way to an order based on money. The monetary order will become universal from Santiago to Beijing, from Johannesburg to Moscow, All economic systems will worship the altar of the market. People everywhere will make sacrifices to the gods of profit. Never before has the world been so captive to the laws dictated by money. Now, that sounds like a false quote. It is not. And I know this because that's an expression of his other agenda, his transhumanism. Something, of course, that's considered inevitable. The word inevitable is disastrous. The left uses this all the time. Things that they bring about, they call inevitable. Money, and the technology that it controls, is the God of Israel, which is precisely the opposite of the purpose of ancient Israel in the Old Testament. It was totally inverted. Totally inverted. I know that this is a real quote. I've read the book. Because Soros says the same thing. Soros calls his project Brave New World, which is, you know, named from Huxley's dystopia. He says, this is Soros now, economic behavior permeates all spheres of activity. Artistic and moral values can be represented in monetary terms. This makes it possible to apply the principles of the market mechanism to such distant fields as art, social life, politics, religion. The scope of the market mechanism is extended to its uttermost limits, euthanasia, genetic engineering. This becomes possible practically because perhaps the most astonishing feature of the ideally changing society is this integration of personal relationships. The organic structure of society is disintegrated to such an extent that its atoms, that is individuals, float freely. Friends, neighbors, husbands, wives become, if not interchangeable, then at least easily replaced by a slightly worse or better option. Under conditions of competition, they also become the object of choice. There are no conspiracies anymore. These men and many others connected to them, they've laid out a system in a society that can't conceive of anything systematically. It shows that their conception of freedom has its terminus in total control. The highest possible freedom of the individual. It's a ruse, a means of empowering the most cohesive financial power on the planet, whether capitalist or socialist. They stand at the head of this pyramid, total power, and are morally different from the people they claim to represent, like workers in the USSR. The Shulchan Aruch, Joseph Carter, is not a moral code at all. And it shouldn't be surprising because we see it in St. John, the Apocalypse. We read chapter 13. Also forces people, great and small, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hands, their foreheads. They could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. Now, at the time, this level of depravity didn't exist anywhere. So details that we know about were inconceivable. The language was not able to express it. The perversion didn't have a root in those languages. That's about as best as they can do. So Jean Cattali, the creator of the European Union, the creator of the idea, global financial control would allow bankers to, quote, gain true supranational powers, planetary power. Now, of course, that's hardly news. But who is ahead of this order? It could only be the Antichrist, the Jewish Messiah. There's a Hasidic website, Times of the Mosaic. Now this is a machine translation. I don't read the language, obviously. They published an article exactly with that title, concerning the nations of the world will be destroyed once the Redeemer arrives. And the question is, in support of the destruction of nations, namely, you know, the ethnicity of the world, there's various interpretations by Jewish books they're given. And Jews are, you know, are kind of divided on this regard. Let me quote from that time of the Mosaic, the Redeemer website. This is an important rabbi. This is not just some guy posting on a forum. It can be assumed that this is not about physical extermination, but about the fact that in the future, the nations of the world will stop producing offspring and will die out on their own. When in the future the truth of the Most High is revealed in the world, all creatures in the world will feel it. They will understand that they have no existence of their own. This is what is said about the Messiah defeating all the sons of Seth. He will show them that their entire existence is nothing. And you clearly see that in the white birth rate. Every one of us knows attractive, intelligent white women who are not having kids. We know usually a bunch of them. That's just genocide by a different method. Now, when they talk about the Most High, they're certainly not talking about Yahweh. They know Yahweh despises them. So the author of this article graciously agrees to leave some of us alive. I mean, some of them has to work for the God-chosen nation. How many will remain? Well, that's a matter of dispute. On the forum of that the Third Temple Recreators website, the forum connected to that journal, people about erecting the Third Temple, they say this: it should be clarified what this time of the end of times is, what's characteristic of the period. As everyone believes, the end of times is the days of the Messiah, the end of times, when the Redeemer comes, which will be the last times of the nations, enemies of God and their kingdoms, their cup will be filled to the end, as it is written, I will destroy all the nations among which I scattered you there. Also the prophets say, at the end of the times, the mountain of the house of God will be prepared on the top of the mountains. Huh. This is what Jacob said, until Shiloh comes, and for its sake the nations shall be destroyed. Now that's an address to the tribe of Judah. The author says they are obviously the key to understanding the aspect of the end times. Now, this is a perverted manipulation of the prophets. The Talmud says the prophets are burning in hell. Atali himself, in his book, A Brief History of the Future, in 2006, he writes that between those who will be destroyed and the winners in this Darwinian world, there'll be a remnant, a middle class. And here's what he says. This is the nature of his transhumanism. The coming world order will turn man into a mass-produced commodity with artificial organs inserted into him. He will himself become an artificial being which can be bought and sold like any other object or commodity. As a result of the development of genetic engineering, man will sell and buy his own doubles, copies of loved ones, hybrids created on the basis of special properties given to him, chosen for very specific purposes. Man will begin to create himself the same way he creates goods. He will search for necessary materials in special warehouses of living organs, consume other people, like other objects, and wander in other people's organisms and brains. Man of the coming millennium will allow himself to be consumed piece by piece in the market sense of the word. In this way, he will join what ultimately goes back to the cult of industrial cannibalism. He actually has several articles on that as well. So this isn't secret doctrine anymore. This is the fourth industrial revolution. This is the mentality of the main ideologists of the regime, coming directly from the scientific and technological developments of the Enlightenment, of course devoid of any concept of sin or logos. How much of a man can be artificial before he can be owned by somebody, before he can become some property? They're openly declaring this. Now, it used to be that evil could not operate openly, in the sense that it couldn't declare its goals openly. So it used various forms of deception. You know, you will be as gods is the main one. So many other false promises. This is why Christ called him the father of lies. The Jews, tempted by him, chose another father. So when Christ said to them, you belong to your father the devil, you want to carry out your father's desires, he was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth. There is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. John 8:44. And they know that he is speaking directly to them today. All of this comes down to sinful pride, the unchanging original goal of Satan and his demons. It's already manifest. We can't really prevent his accession to power. It is a consequence of man's departure from God. It is, however, in our power to resist the Antichrist in order to save what we can. The camp of the saints, the beloved city, in Revelation chapter 20. And Orthodox Russia is the main actor here. That the only power that could lead this resistance, the conception I developed in grad school in the 1990s, given their alienation from the West, natural resources, military, the fact they could be totally autarkic, self-sufficient, they don't trust the West. I remember the moment I came up with it. I was waiting for my girlfriend outside of Montgomery Ward. She was working there. And it hit me. I was thinking about Alexander Lebed and the right wing that was developing in Russia. If they took over, this is what Russia could be. That's the last hope. I distinctly remember the moment. It occurred to me that Russia truly is the center of the world, spiritually speaking. But resistance must begin with the awareness of the spiritual scale of the problem. Our various financial, economic defenses. Economics is not based on immutable laws. Nothing is inevitable here. Nothing is immutable or inevitable. I wrote a paper in 2023, one I'm quite proud of. Rent-seeking and asset-stripping, the political economy of postmodern oligarchy. Concerning the foundation, how do we understand economics where markets don't exist anymore? In total globalization, the market and oligarchy can't coexist. So the nature of economic analysis is damaged at a time when the assumptions of economic theory don't longer correspond to reality. Oligarchy has its own laws that are non-market laws. But we read, you know, in 2025, economic analysis relies on mythic ideas of a functional market at the expense of these very powerful institutions. Those making policy at both public and private levels don't seem to realize that these assumptions don't apply anymore. The myth of the free market leads to destructive policies because markets are purely abstract and hypothetical. Oligarchy, that is, plutocracy, the master institution, is quite concrete. It doesn't distort markets, it replaces them altogether. That's why the predictions of economists never come true. That's why they talk about economic recovery, where none exists. Oligarchy, regime, I use those synonymously. All the ruling elements. Not just a state or large corporations. It's a complex of academia, journalism, entertainment, the high-tech sector, medical, media, politics, finance, military. They set policy in informal meetings. And even those are becoming more and more public. Economics has been humiliated by endless bad predictions. And I know why. Because they base themselves on market hypotheses when they live in a globalized oligarchy. And that hasn't been, there's no theory to structure it other than me. I only just gave the foundation, just the basis. The cure. Things like corporatism. You know, how did Germany become a world power again in a few years? You know, corporatism, class solidarity, or I should say estate solidarity rather than capitalist exploitation or socialist exploitation. They use the word fascism to describe it. Projects like the free money theory proposed in the 1930s by Silvio Gesell. Money is only the instrument of exchange, free of interest. Local application of the practice was successful, but prohibited elsewhere. The Islamic idea, especially in Iran, very similar to the corporatist and the fascist one. I just say the National Socialist one. With National Socialists are not fascists, but recognizes the right to private property, but ownership should be limited and performs, in essence, a social function. All property belongs to God. And any right of an individual is related to the right of use. If used incorrectly, it can be confiscated. Meaning, the public good prevails over the private good. All natural resources must be under the commonwealth. And that's a matter of national law. Natural law, I should say. Basic rules of economic activity. The best developed NS Germany and Iran. Every Muslim must work to ensure his existence. Any form of profit without personal contribution in the form of work or risk is prohibited, including usury, just another form of rent. Or rent, another form of usury. In order to make a profit, the banker must be a shareholder. Economic success is a gift from God, so material goods must serve spiritual purposes, as I said above. The concept of wealth in the Old Testament, in the classic era, has no connection to the concept of wealth today. There's so many theories, which, of course, I'm in no position to get into right now. But there are so many, in terms of economics and political theory, our movement has so much, and academia is so stagnant. It's stagnant because it's controlled by a single master institution, especially economics, which is the worst of all. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.